Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you can afford it, our nation is supposed to have some of the best medical treatment, medicine, in the world. But right now, in the United States, we've got a raft of prescription drugs, vital treatments, unavailable at any price, or at shady, gray market prices so high it looks criminal. Prescription drug shortages in the heart of American healthcare. You may have heard the reports. You may have suffered the shortage. We want to know why. What is going on? This hour on Point, what's behind the drug shortages? You can join the conversation. Hospitals, doctors, are you struggling to treat? Patients, are you struggling to survive? What's going on with these missing drugs and our drug industry and oversight? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You can hear the desperation, the voice here. This is in a FDA medical panel hearings just last week in Silver Spring, Maryland. Here's President of the American College of Emergency Physicians, Dr. Frederick Bloom, making a plea to get the drugs coming.
Pharmaceutical representatives spend bazillions of dollars trying to influence me to buy their drug. On most of these drugs, I'm sold. I'll buy them, you know. I'll use them, okay? Just make them.
Just make them. Just make them, please. Joining me first today from Washington, D.C. is Jennifer Corbett-Doran. She's the Food and Drug Administration reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Jennifer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
From the numbers, it looks like we're seeing an all-time high of prescription drug shortages. The latest tally I saw for this year was 213. That's several times, maybe five times, what we saw just a handful of years ago. Are these exotic drugs, Jennifer? Are these weird, out-of-the-way drugs that almost nobody uses, or what?
No, in fact, these are very common drugs. I like to refer to them as hospital-based drugs. These are chemotherapy drugs, anesthesia drugs, drugs that are used in the emergency room, used in critical care units. These are typically not drugs that are in short supply when you're going to the pharmacy to, say, refill a prescription for a cholesterol medication. These are very important drugs that are used in hospital settings and in, you know, outpatient clinics, cancer treatment centers.
And I'm reading that they generally tend to be, correct me if I'm wrong, generic drugs.
They are. I mean, a lot of these drugs have been on the market for decades. They're old drugs, but they are still the backbone of treatment in hospitals. These chemotherapy drugs are used to treat a lot of cancers. They're often the first treatment of choice. You know, there's a lot of newer sort of targeted therapies on the market for cancer, and those are used, but they're also used in addition to the backbone chemotherapy drugs.
So when you say that they're older drugs, that doesn't mean they're ineffective drugs. In fact, you're calling them backbone of treatment drugs, mainstays.
Right. They are mainstay treatments, and you know, generally what happens is, like I said, these drugs are used first. You know, if you have breast cancer, it's often surgery and then a cocktail of usually three chemotherapy drugs that are put in the IV and used to treat that. Then you may go on, depending on what type of breast cancer you have, to have some of the newer brand name drugs. But like I said, it's these backbone drugs that many of them are in short supply.
We're really frustrated at a lack of explanation. One key factor to bear in mind here, as I'm reading you and others, Jennifer, these tend to be injected drugs, not just pills that can sit on a shelf for a long, long time. These are injected, what, fluids, by and large, that have to be kept in certain conditions to be...
Exactly. I mean, they're made, these are fluids. They're generally manufactured in small glass vials or bigger glass vials, depending on what the hospitals need.
Right.
But they are, it is, the company said, this is typically a more complex manufacturing process than, say, making a pill. And these are made in older plants. There were down to about seven companies that are making these drugs in the United States. And the plants are aging. They're running at full capacity. And when you hit a problem, that's one of the reasons these shortages are being created. If they have a manufacturing problem, the other manufacturers are running at full capacity. It's very hard to shift gears and then make more of whatever drug is in short supply without creating another shortage.
Let's hone in here then. You say most of these, or all of them, are tend to be generics. Exactly. Now, we know generics have smaller profit margins. So are they being shunted off to old factories because, you know, the drug manufacturers don't make much money on them? Maybe that's obvious that they are.
Well, you have a lot of – some of these companies are companies that actually specialize in making these generic drugs. So that is their line of business, and that it is important to them. But as you said, the profits are not that big. I think one doctor was telling me a dose of a particular chemotherapy drug was $7 for a dose.
Okay. And compared to, I mean, you name it.
Compared to, it can be hundreds or thousands of dollars a dose for a newer cancer drug.
And yet that's their business, and these are mainline backbone drugs, you say. So there's the profit issue. We'll look at that as this hour rolls forward. Talk to us about a couple of other things. One is, what about drug companies taking their manufacturing offshore? Is that an issue here with quality control in China or India?
I think in this case, it's not as much. In this case, these, like I said, they're made in older plants. The FDA has said that, I think they were saying about half of the shortages this year, or last year, were because of manufacturing problems. That you were, in some cases there were metal shavings in these glass vials, glass particles.
That strikes me as weird, if I may say so. These have been made for decades, some of them. Why would there suddenly be manufacturing problems in this country? I mean, why?
Well, part of it is that what they're saying is that some of the companies have not been, because their plants are running at generally at full capacity,
yep,
that have not been taking lines down to you know, make sure that you're complying with all sorts of
manufacturing process controls. That, what about consolidation in the industry? Does that left us with fewer manufacturers? Is that part of the problem?
It has over time. I mean, a lot of these forces have happened over time, and they've really come to a head in the last couple of years. That there's been a gradual consolidation in the industry. That, you know, each year your plants get older. If you're not taking things down to perform needed upgrades, you're eventually going to run into problems.
Some things really surprised me in reading up on this, the amount of theft that seems to be going on here. Now, you get shortages, then people are desperate, and suddenly whole crates of these drugs seem to be disappearing. Why that much insecurity in the drug supply chain?
You know, I'm honestly not sure about all of that. There have been thefts of prescription drugs, including these sterile injectables, but there's also been thefts of you know, the type of drugs, like I was saying, cholesterol drugs that, you know, when you go to your pharmacy to fill those drugs. I mean, it's people out there trying to make a buck.
Of course, that brings us to the gray market. Now you can't get these things through regular channels, and suddenly hospitals, big and small, are desperate to have them. I'm reading here about somebody who looking for a blood pressure medicine, normally priced at $25 a dose. It was offered to hospitals for $1,200 a dose. What's going on with the gray market, Jennifer?
Well, these, you know, again, people are trying to make a buck. There is a shortage situation, so you have, you know, unscrupulous vendors who are finding ways to get some of these drugs, and then they're turning around and offering to hospitals at these very high prices. It's a worse problem in some states than other states. You know, drug distribution is still largely controlled at the state level.
And yet we're seeing this show up not just in smaller communities, but in some of the biggest, most prestigious hospitals in the country. We're looking at 15 deaths in 15 months from an AP story I saw last week. They're also reporting what was, I think, last year in Alabama, where they were so desperate to get a batch of liquid nutrition for people who can't eat in a normal way that they sort of whipped up their own batch. It went bad. 9 people died, 10 harmed.
Right. Yeah, and the hospitals, I mean, they're in a really tough spot. I mean, ideally, most hospitals said they would prefer not to have to go to the gray market. They don't, you know, you don't know how good this drug is. You know, these are sterile injectable drugs that should be kept in certain, you know, ideal conditions, not too hot, not too cold.
Right.
Hospitals are trying not to go this route, but when you need to get a drug, you know, some of them are doing it.
Do you have any sense of how many people nationally at this point are at risk of being affected by these shortages? Are we talking thousands, tens of thousands? I mean, the deaths are certainly mounting up. How big is the vulnerability?
Honestly, it's anybody that goes into a hospital. I mean, it's not just the cancer drugs, it's drugs that are used in the emergency room, critical care unit. You know, we talked a little bit ago about the nutrition drugs.
Yeah.
That people who are on, you know, needing to get fluids on their IV, there are components that are being left out of these solutions because the hospitals can't get them.
In other words,
this is going to cause a problem. Mm-hmm. You're not sure what mm-hmm. happens if you leave, say, an important vitamin out of a solution for a few days. Does that hurt somebody? It may not immediately hurt them, but down the line, who knows?
Is there nobody in the country, Jennifer, who's responsible for sort of staying on top of this and making sure it doesn't happen?
It's, well, you know, you have the government, you got the Food and Drug Administration, their parent agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, trying to grapple with this problem, but they can't force companies to make drugs. They have been, you know, the FDA has been trying to work with these companies if they've hit a manufacturing problem. In one case, they discovered with one of the cancer drugs, there were crystals of the drug in the vial, which in an ideal circumstance shouldn't be happening, but found out if you warm it up to a certain temperature, the crystals disappear and you could still go ahead and use this drug.
Boy, suddenly we're making do.
2 years ago, this wouldn't happen. The FDA would have come in and said to a company and said, you can't have this. You need to
take it back and make it right.
Yeah. Until you fix it. But then that can exacerbate a shortage.
And when people are desperate, they turn to desperate measures. But why is the question we're raising today? Jennifer Corbett-Doran, we're going to dive on in. Thank you very much for being with us from the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the surge of prescription drug shortages plaguing hospitals and patients around the country, asking what is really going on here. With us right now from Stanford, California, is oncologist Dr. Michael Link. He is president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, professor of hematology and oncology at Stanford University's School of Medicine. He's called the wave of drug shortages unconscionable. Dr. Michael Link, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
I'm seeing you quoted saying these shortages are just killing us. Talk to us just for a minute about the impact in the world of cancer treatment.
Well, as you heard in the first segment, these are drugs that have been the mainstays of treatment for many cancers, and these are the mainstays of curative treatments, not the ones that prolong life for a few months, but these are drugs that have actually resulted in cures and are life-saving. Now, I'm a pediatric oncologist, so I take care of children with cancer, and some of these drugs are really the whole therapy. We can now cure almost 80% of children with cancer, and yet without these drugs, our hands are tied. And even for adults with leukemia, a couple of the drugs that have been in short supply, without them, they can't be treated.
And again, these are not exotic drugs. These are mainline drugs.
These are drugs that have been around for 20, 30 years, have been the first major, have resulted in the major advances in cancer treatment. And as I say, for frontline treatment, as you heard in the first segment, these are usually at least part of the regimens. For example, the drug cisplatin was a drug that revolutionized the care of testicular cancer, a very common cancer mm-hmm. in young adult men. Mm-hmm. Without it, you really don't have that curative therapy available.
So what are people up against, patients? What are hospitals up against? What's happening out there, doctor?
Well, of course, our hospitals are doing everything possible to get the drugs. And as you heard about this, the distributors are able to mark up the prices because the drug is in short supply. But we know that we need these drugs, and so hospitals are willing to pay the extra in order to have the drugs available to treat our patients because our patients, of course, come first.
But some are clearly being just left without. 15 have died in the last 15 months, we read here. 9 or 10 mm-hmm. in Alabama in one incident trying to substitute or make up their own nutritional fluids there. Mm-hmm. Being given other drugs with terrible side effects, fingernails falling out or you name it, because mm-hmm. they can't get the one they need.
Well, I think the most important problem is, and now I'm talking about the anti-cancer drugs specifically, mm-hmm. the most important thing is not to be able to give the best therapy. So to give anything less than the best that we know works the best is, of course, a terrible problem for us. There are, though, introduced the problems of what do you do when you don't have that drug. And I think that, remember, the majority of adults with cancer in the United States are treated in relatively small practices in the community. And they don't have the leverage of big hospitals to pay the extra markup to get the drugs from or to use multiple distributors. So that's where we're most worried. And even delays in therapy. So it's not like you can't get the drug, but you may not get it on time. You may have to wait an extra week or two to get your therapy. That's not good. That's not good cancer care. We know that that will, in a large aggregate of patients, will probably have a negative effect on the outcome.
It just seems incredible. After all the screaming and hollering about rationing and all the rest, here we are, rationed or just plain not available. We're trying to figure out why. And I'm reading you quoted here saying, and maybe it's just obvious, right here in your quote, you say these shortages are killing us. You say these drugs save lives, and it's unconscionable that medicines that cost a couple of bucks a vial are unavailable. Maybe there's the answer right there. They only cost $2 a vial. It's not worth anybody making them.
Well, of course, there's a lot of theories out there, depending on who you ask, as to why there's a shortage. Some of it, as you've heard, is manufacturing difficulties. Now, what is the manufacturing difficulties? It's the problem is that if you're not making much money on that drug, and there is a problem manufacturing it, the incentive to go and fix the problem is minimized, because why would you turn over and spend a lot of money in fixing a problem when the drug is a loser to begin with? So we have to understand that in this, in the way things work here, that a company has to make sound business decisions for their stockholders, and so they are free to make whatever is in their best interest. So if a drug is too problematic, and these drugs are complicated to make because these are mostly intravenous injectable drugs, if they have a problem making one, they may very well not fix that problem and turn to making something which may be more profitable for them.
So, but you'd wonder, why doesn't the market just fix this? If there's a shortage, usually that means the price goes up a little bit and people come in to respond to it, but it shouldn't be going up from $25 a dose to $1,200 a dose, as we have seen here. I'm reading, this is from a professor of medical ethics and health policy at University of Pennsylvania. Now, this is Ezekiel Emanuel, happens to be Rahm Emanuel's brother, who, of course, was chief of staff to President Obama. He's saying that the problem goes back in part to legislation that came through back in 2003 under President Bush, the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act, that controls pricing, controls the pace in time at which prices can go up in a more orderly way. Do you track it? Maybe this is a regulatory problem. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, well, remember, of course, Dr. Emanuel is an oncologist, so he's certainly faced this problem as well, and I talked to him about that in that piece that he wrote.
Yep.
So his hypothesis is, and I agree with it, that the problem here is that when a drug goes off patent and becomes generic, the price drops precipitously as the companies that are making the generic version try to get market share. The problem is because of that 2003 legislation, the price can't go up so fast. So Medicare or CMS, which, of course, the majority of patients with cancer are Medicare patients, they control how rapidly the price can go back up, and they make it so that the reimbursement rate is the average sales price plus only 6% margin there for handling.
Okay.
And so the problem is that if and they can't raise that average sales price more than every 6 months. So it goes down, plummets very quickly, but it ratchets up very, very slowly, even if the drug is in short supply. And
so,
you see it, that the market forces didn't work. We, as you said, we do have a shortage, and yet there's not a lot of other companies jumping in to try to fill that shortage because there really isn't much profit to be made on these drugs.
So do you see a regulatory problem or a market functioning problem or the intersection of those two, which can sometimes, you know, gum up the gears?
Well, I think that this is an example of where it's really not a market, because this regulation is getting in the way of the market. As Dr. Emanuel suggested, maybe instead of having just a 6% margin, maybe they should crank that up to somewhere more like 30 to 50% to give more incentive to these generic pharmaceutical companies to get into the business and make the drug, especially when one manufacturer is willing to go out of business. Somebody else will fill the gap. If there's no incentive to get into the business, you're not going to have other companies sort of putting their manufacturing facilities, which are limited, towards making drugs on which they can't make much money.
And yet, here are all these people who need these drugs, and it's for very straightforward things, things that cause a lot of pain and death, and we know how to treat them. The drug's not there. It's kind of unbelievable. Michael Link is with us. Dr. Michael Link, he's president of the American Society of clinical oncology. Cancer treatment's taking a lot of the weight of this drug shortages that are hitting the country. We've got a lot of skepticism online here. One listener says, simply put, shortages, scarcity of drugs lead to higher profit margins. Any good drug dealer knows that. Dr. Link, please stand by. Joining us right now from Boston is Wells Wilkinson, staff attorney with Community Catalyst, a national consumer advocacy organization, advocating for a greater consumer voice in health and healthcare. Wells Wilkinson, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see going on in these drug shortages that are hitting all over the country in record numbers?
Well, I think these drug shortages are of serious concern to consumers and consumer advocates, and we need to do something to address them. And I do think that there is a problem here with the intersection of both the manufacturers that market these drugs and bring them to the U.S. market, and the regulations which we need to ensure that these manufacturers do so in a safe, quality-controlled manner. I will say one thing we should mention about the pricing restrictions that were put in place in 2003. People should know that those pricing restrictions were actually put in place because the drug manufacturers had, for at least a decade, hyperinflated so-called list prices so that they could bilk Medicare Part B out of, you know, significant billions of dollars of losses by inflating the list price that Medicare would reimburse the doctor for when the doctor actually paid a very small price.
Did you advocate for those price controls on these drugs? Did your organization, Wells, advocate for that?
So my organization actually was involved in some of the class action litigation around those price increases and the fraud, the widespread fraud.
So do you regret the way it was architected? Was it somehow designed wrong, these regulations? Because look at this outcome we've got here.
So you actually could make the point that these pricing controls were really necessary for the very expensive brand name drugs, and we might need a separate set of prices for, you know, what are these very low cost generic drugs. So there may be a way to, you know, remodel this to treat those other low-cost drugs differently. And you also could have CMS more quickly calculate what the prices are on average so that the price could go up more quickly.
Why is this going on in the United States? I don't read about it going on in Canada or Europe or other developed countries. Why is it going on here, do you think, Wells?
That's a good question, actually. Dr. Link can answer a question about whether Europe or Japan use the same drugs that we do to treat cancer.
Dr. Link, what about it?
Oh yeah, these are drugs that are used worldwide. I mean, it's not that these are unique to the United States.
Are there shortages in Tokyo or Hokkaido or, you know, Germany?
Well, there are shortages in the UK that we know for sure. So these are not confined to the United States, although it's probably worse here. But it's also true that the pricing of generics and on patent drugs is different in Europe, for example, than they are here. So the prices on the generic drugs are a little higher, and the prices for the drugs that are on patent are a little lower than they are in the United States. And so they may have struck a better balance in terms of the differences in how these drugs are priced.
Michael Link, Wells Wilkinson, stand by. A lot of listeners want to join us. Let me go to Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. We also got to connect the dots, and we never do this. In our culture, we're teaching situational ethics, existentialism, and values clarification, and we think there's not going to be any ramifications. People don't care about people anymore. There's no ethics. There's no morality. And then you go with the global economy. They're going where they can get the most money, and that's all they care about.
Craig, I hear it very clearly. If ethics were more at the table, Michael Link, where would they show up here and how?
Well, I think that you have to understand that physicians that are taking care of patients are clearly advocates for our patients, and we want to deliver the drugs. I mean, we need them. The problem is that this is a problem of, as you heard from the regulation, the FDA really doesn't have the authority to make somebody make the drugs. So the kinds of solutions that are being thought of are really related to what can we do about this, whether we should stockpile it. I can assure you that government agencies are interested in the possible solutions for this problem, but it has to be within the existing authorities that are available. And I have to say about the FDA, they do have a drug shortage office, which has been very, very helpful in trying to facilitate getting drugs that are in short supply from alternative sources.
And yet there's some systemic problem here. You've got a drug shortage office and a drug shortage epidemic at the same time. We're talking about exactly that. Let's get a call from Sam in Natick, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody. Thank you again for bringing something that is very, very vital to our national security, because without our health, we're not going nowhere. Well, Tom, you know, here is a problem. A gentleman there talked about the stratification and the pricing differences, variations between Canada, United States, and Japan.
Yes.
Well, no one actually seems to face the fact, what is the cost and what's the effect. The cost, definitely, everybody knows it, but nobody wants to go there, is our health policy. As someone who is educated in pharmacy,
yes,
medicine, public health, and healthcare policy and management. Look, but these things are very easy to figure out. We have no health policy. If we have health policy, preferably a taboo word, a poisonous word that nobody wants to hear, single-payer system, all these things will disappear. Then everybody knows, generic companies know that will be paid a certain amount, and that amount, just like in Europe, just like in Japan, just like in other countries. The problem here is that this, at best, Mickey Mouse health policy.
Sam, let us pick it up right there. I have to say that you read in here at crates of this stuff disappearing, a gray market with huge markups, people kind of selling it around like back alley dealers here, very important drugs, and it does sound a little Wild West, a little off the hook. Wells, what about it? Sam says, make a single payer, make some big change to the system itself, and you'll fix this. Is that clear to you, Wells, well, that's the problem?
I do think that the caller is right, that the availability of these drugs is being driven almost entirely by the market, and there's not a sound policy that requires manufacturers to, for instance, let FDA know ahead of time when they think they're going to have a shortage, nor is there sound policy to make sure these drugs are manufactured and stockpiled ahead of time. And for that matter, there's not even enough support and financially and legal authority otherwise for the FDA to do an adequate job to inspect a new manufacturer when they want to enter the market. So we need to improve FDA's global presence, because these drugs are being manufactured by and large overseas.
Michael Link, 80%
of active ingredients come from overseas, and 40% of finished drug products come from overseas these days.
Michael Link, when you're trying to treat cancer patients, are you envious of oncologists in other countries where drug pricing is more certain, has more clarity and certainty around it, as our caller suggests?
Well, I think our caller is suggesting, a whole different topic, and probably not enough time in this program to discuss the U.S. health policy.
Well,
but it is a problem when we have market-driven issues can cause problems. And I want to be clear that the markups are happening actually by the distributors. So if a drug company would tell the FDA that there's going to be a shortage because they're going out of business or because they're having manufacturing difficulties, this is exactly the signal for the distributors to hoard the supply that's available and then sell it at a markup. So that the distributors are not capped by the same legislation as the manufacturers and the physicians are when they use these drugs. So, there's a lot of problems when you allow this to be totally market-driven and when we don't have a central system for really understanding where the drugs are and what to do about it. Now, for example, in the U.K.,
Dr. Link. We'll come right back and look at that. Dr. Michael Link, president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, joining us there from Stanford, California. Wells Wilkinson with Community Catalyst, joining us today from Boston. Wells, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the explosion of prescription drug shortages in this country, plaguing hospitals and patients around the United States, asking what is going on here. Dr. Michael Link is with us this hour from Stanford, California, president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. He's a practicing oncologist there, pediatric oncology. Think of those kids without the drugs they need. We'll hear in just a moment from a head of drug procurement at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. But first, a couple of calls from Memphis, Tennessee. Aaron is calling. Aaron, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to share my perspective real quick. I'm a pharmacist, and I work at a national hospice pharmacy, and we serve hospices and hospice patients all throughout the U.S.
Okay.
And we're having shortages as well. One of the medications we use a lot of are for end-of-life secretions, and we're having a terrible time getting our medications. You know, one goes short, so we'll use another one. Well, then that one will be short. Stuff like scopolamine patches, stuff like that, we're having trouble getting as well.
Aaron, may I ask you, you're trying to help people die with dignity here. Are these generic drugs? What's happening? Is this a new problem? How do you interpret what's going on?
These are generic drugs, just like the hospital pharmacy drugs. This is stuff like scopolamine that's been around for a long time.
So what happens to people if you can't get it? How does their experience of death change if you can't get these drugs?
I would say it just makes everything more difficult. You know, it makes our doctors, our hospice nurses, it just makes everything more difficult as added stress. For us, we are usually able to substitute with something else, but then a few months later, that becomes in short supply as well. So it's just a lot of juggling that we're having to do to serve our patients as well.
Aaron, good luck there. That's an important population, and I appreciate your call from Memphis. One more right here, Jake from Hartford, Connecticut. Jake, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How's it going? My perspective on this is that the players interested here are not exactly coming from a weak position, because hospitals are in a position perhaps where they can organize and create some kind of specialized nonprofit that manufactures these drugs. And I think that would take care of seeing that the process is not compromised like it might be in the gray market.
That's an interesting thought.
They might even save money.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. We've got a real big purchasing community here. Maybe there's some leverage right there. Dr. Michael Link in California, please stand by. Maybe to help us look at that, let me turn to Nashville, Tennessee, and Dr. Michael O'Neill, pharmacist and head of drug procurement at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Michael O'Neill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us, Tom, and getting this group together.
I want to talk about this idea of maybe could we put a nonprofit together to work with these drugs where the margins are lower, but let's just hold that for a second and ask you. You're right there in the middle of a very big medical center. Are you confronting this problem of prescription drug shortages?
Oh, absolutely. And this is something that's interesting that it's gotten such heightened attention here recently. This is something we've been dealing with for well over 2 years, and it started classically with the drug propofol that was in the media 2 years ago and created a lot of angst in our operative services in the operating world. And we're able to kind of maneuver our way through that, but really had points where we had no product. And it's made its way, as everyone said, through the entire generic portfolio of drugs that have been around forever. And it's, I like the thought, it's really hit every corner of the hospital. And it's really created a lot of operational issues and safety concerns. And
wow.
Dr. Link, go ahead.
What's propofol? Is that the one we heard in the Michael Jackson case, his death?
Yes, sir.
So that's anesthetic kind?
It is. It is, and it's a drug that went generic in the last, I think, 5 to 7 years. So several manufacturers were making it, I think, at one point when it went generic off patent. I think there were 5 different manufacturers. There was a problem with the product being produced out of California with Teva. And so they basically went offline, which put all the pressure on 2 of the others that were still making it. One of the manufacturers had already gotten out of the propofol business just because of the complexity. So it left it to 2 manufacturers, and then Hospira had quality issues with theirs. So then it left 1 manufacturing in the scene producing propofol for really the entire United States.
So do you have doctors? I don't know. You know, in their operating room and their scrubs turning to you and saying, you know, Mike, where are the drugs? We got a problem here.
Well, there was testimony, certainly, and that example was given last week at the FDA workshop in Silver Springs. We hope that we're good communicators, to be honest with you, prior to actually running out. But we've had some harrowing experiences where physicians, practitioners didn't realize what had been going on behind the scenes. And so the communication piece, I think that came up time and time again last Monday, is just vital. So we recognize we're in a crisis, so now we've got to get in crisis mode and make sure we're taking care of business in regard to communication, and I'm really getting good information from the manufacturers so that we can all make plans and protocols, new protocols now based on what we have available.
This could hit any of us, our mothers, brothers, sisters. I mean, as citizens, we're sort of listening closely here and trying to figure out if there's something that needs to be done. We're hearing a lot of angles on how this problem has emerged, but what's your take on what's at the core of the problem, Michael O'Neill? Why do you think this is going on in such greater frequency than it did in the past?
Well, so that's the million-dollar question, and if you can go back and look at the tapes or watch the video from last Monday at the FDA, I think the session really closed with a physician asking that very question. And so the industry spoke up and gave, or one of the manufacturers did, their opinion on that, and it was had to do, a lot to do with what we've touched on today, manufacturing issues, quality issues, and basically having to ramp down or discontinue production until those can be corrected. The other angle really is the whole profit angle and the economics of it, and that's come up several times today. I mean, I think people are asking that question, and so that would be what I classify as more the skeptical side. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the reality of it. I think that generic drugs have become so commoditized that I don't know what the impetus is for these manufacturers to, as someone pointed out earlier, to correct a problem that may cost millions of dollars to correct, when they know once the lines are running again, the margin is so small that it just the incentive is not there. And so what we're kicking and screaming as clinicians is saying, well, that's fine, but these are drugs that we use every day. They're bread and butter drugs. We cannot go without them. And so that's the message we continue to send back up from practice to the industry and to the FDA. Something has to be done. So it's a voice of desperation. And the question is, why? Why is this happening, and who's going to step up and fix it?
Voice of desperation right there from the front line. Dr. Michael Link, listening there in California, people are listening very closely to you today. You were saying earlier that these cancer drugs, which are now running into shortages all over the place, they've been around a long time, and they're curative, as opposed to maybe fancier, more high-tech new drugs that prolong life for a little while at very high cost. And here's a listener, Roy, says, this is supply management. It has nothing to do with production or delivery costs, only pharma's desire to maximize profitability from products. No drug company will ever seek to cure disease. Maximum margins from keeping patients with chronic symptoms alive. Is that shift at work here, Dr. Link? Is that part of what's going on? Why cure it when you can sell something very expensive that just prolongs life for a while?
Well, that would be the most cynical view of all. I can't believe that, especially when we're talking about treating children, where we know we have curative therapies and they're going to live long lives. I mean, I think that
But you're the one who pointed it out, that the curative ones are the ones you can't get your hands on, and the ones that prolong for a couple of months, they're there.
Right, but I don't. But remember, when the treatment doesn't work, yeah, it's not that we are able then to treat this as a chronic disease in children who will need the drugs forever. This is that they're going to die of their disease. So I think that we need those curative therapies, because for cancer patients, it's a more or less all or nothing. They either get cured, and if they're not cured, they're going to die of their disease. And dealing with that, let's say, in a 5 or 6 year old child, would be one of the most difficult problems to face. So I think that would be the most cynical view. I don't even believe that the manufacturers believe that. I do want to come back to one of the issues about a not-for-profit, because that we're interested in any potential solution. And, of course, there has been a proposal to start a not-for-profit to make at least the anti-cancer drugs, which are relatively low volume compared to some of the other drugs that are being used. Mm-hmm. But that's a solution that's being entertained. And, there's the worry about, if the big drug manufacturers can't do it, why would a not-for-profit be able to? And that's some of the concern. But we're in this to try to get the drugs to deliver to our patients, and so we will try any and all solutions that are likely to help.
Is the pharmaceutical industry supportive of a not-for-profit to take care of the generics if there's not much margin there, or do they oppose it because when there is demand, the margins can get very high indeed?
Well, we've heard that they're willing to give the NDAs, which means their recipes, if you will, and their license to do it, to a not-for-profit to let somebody else do it. They're willing to offload it because it may not suit their business needs. And so we think that at least we're entertaining that notion that it may be in their interest to give up on the manufacture of these anti-cancer drugs and give it to somebody who actually is willing to not to have a bottom line as the motivation for whether to make the drugs or not.
So maybe there's something there in our caller's suggestion. Let's go to Seattle, Washington, and Anthony. Anthony in Seattle, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'll be brief. I mean, I could speak about this for, you know, hours if given the chance, but I work in a specialty psychiatric pharmacy. We've been having a really, really tough time finding long-acting injectables.
Okay.
And, you know, my only comment was going to be that these shortages, you know, they're tragic for everybody, but in our context, they also pose a very big threat to public health because a lot of these folks have been stable on these drugs for years. And, you know, now we're having to posit that, you know, practitioners are going to have to make different decisions in terms of what they're going to have to do with these folks. And
they may be a danger to themselves or others.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is happening right now, Anthony, in Seattle? What's going on?
I think that a lot of your guests are mentioning, you know, they're hitting all the right points. I think it's just, you know, side effects of legislation and policy and, you know, the profit motive, really, when it all comes down to it. But I don't think anybody's calculating, you know, the threat to public health, for one thing. And then once we do switch around medications, if these patients don't respond, we're going to have to put them in, you know, higher cost avenues, you know, hospitalizations, yeah, which can cost thousands and thousands of dollars a day. So, you know, like a lot of your guests are saying, we could have very cheap drugs that are going to, you know, keep our healthcare costs down. And in fact, you know, since a few folks want to make some money, we're, you know, going to have to hospitalize folks, and it's going to wind up just costing the system a ton of money, more money than it has to, really.
The cheap drugs go away, aren't available, and all kinds of fallout from that. You're describing even others, public health things in the psychiatric realm. It's really interesting. Anthony in Seattle, thank you very much for your call. We're talking about the surging shortage problem in the realm of prescription drugs. Let's go to Gordon in Charlotte, North Carolina. Gordon, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
As a someone who's witnessed this type of thing in three different countries on a couple of different continents, it never ceases to amaze me that we're faced with an industry here that thrives on the misery of others. So the profit motive is what it's all about. You know, I've heard it many times said that the federal government is a wholly owned subsidiary of the pharmaceutical industry. And I think this whole conversation is working towards that. You know, all the other countries in the world, westernized anyway, seem to have managed to overcome these problems. Why can't we?
Well, Gordon, I appreciate your call, and I thank you for it. But then, Michael O'Neill, we heard earlier, you mentioned it yourself, this effort at controlling price increases in for Medicare, you know, maybe coming back to bite in a little way here, because then the margin's not enough, and so people aren't manufacturing those generics, Michael. I don't know. It's hard to know which way then the knife is cutting from.
I would agree. I think Wells had made that comment. And so really there's been some views, and I have to agree with the callers, and I certainly understand their angles. I really think that it's going to require the manufacturers. And I will say this, I'm convinced because we've been asking the questions at Vanderbilt about the collaborative efforts of the manufacturers themselves. So they need to let down a bit of their profit model walls, if you will, and work with each other and work with the FDA and become a bit more accustomed in this crisis mode to overcoming a public health issue. And I think that's one thing that I was encouraged of from last week is just the fact that the FDA and these clinical societies and practitioners and the manufacturing world are coming together. Now, some may say, well, that happened the year before, too, with very little turnout. But yeah, we have to continue to press this conversation. And I'll go back to the caller who made the point about ethics and caring. I can assure you that Dr. Link, I'll speak for him because I know his situation as well here at Vanderbilt. When we look patient in the eyes, we're caring, all right? And we have no other option other than to really ask the very hard question and get down to the bottom of it. And so that's why we continue to press this conversation back up from practice, up through all the regulatory issues and through the manufacturing and profit models to say, we demand something change here.
We've got health care reform coming on, unless the Supreme Court overturns it or we get a new administration and a rejection in Congress. But the Obama health care reforms are on the rails and coming toward us, Michael Link. Is there anything in there that would change the structure around manufacturing and payment for these drugs that might improve this and the reforms that are headed our way?
Well, I don't know for sure that will solve the problem. It will certainly guarantee that patients have access. I mean, we have other problems related to treating these patients because they simply don't have access at all, even if whereas now we have the problem of patients having access, but we don't have the drugs. So maybe we'll take some of the profit motive out of the system, but I'm not sure that that's going to solve this particular problem.
Is there a silver bullet here, or is this a systemic change required to try and get on top of this, Dr. Link?
Well, I think I agree with what's been said, what you just heard, that I think that we have been doing our best to keep the issue in the limelight. And we, of course, thank you very much for having this as a major focus to sort of keep the pressure on. We are going to need help from our legislators, and there is some legislation that has been proposed, although some of that is problematic and may not solve this problem in the short term. But we're going to have to keep the pressure on to revise some of these to at least get to the what we think are the causes of this, and to try to address those causes in order to really relieve this problem, because we are, as you've heard, we're desperate to solve this problem.
Real people and real pain at the other end of this problem, and it seems so unnecessary. We're grateful to the two of you and more for being with us today. Michael O'Neill, pharmacist, head of drug procurement at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville. Michael O'Neill, thank you very much for joining us.
Again, thank you for having this conversation.
And Dr. Michael Link, president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, joining us today from Stanford, California. Dr. Link, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We're paying attention. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.